Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
My guest today is Jennifer Bartlett, who is a professor of history in the Renaissance era at Toronto University. And this week, we are going to discuss a very particular city of the Renaissance history, and we're going to discuss the Florentines, or history of Florence, from Dante to Galileo. But first, I want to learn a little bit about you yourself, and what was it about the Renaissance era that got you so intrigued to study it?
Well, when I began my PhD, I actually started working on English humanism and the influence of humanist texts on English education at Cambridge in the 16th century. But I won a fellowship, a Mellon Fellowship, to study in Italy. And as soon as I got off the plane in Rome, I realized that's really where I belonged. So I switched in order to study really travelers and scholars in Italy during the Renaissance. And then that led to my general interest in Renaissance history and Renaissance culture. So my specialty really is a very interdisciplinary approach to humanism, in as much as I use art and architecture, literary texts, as well as the standard historical context, in order to study this period from several perspectives to create a kind of mosaic of the Italian Renaissance.
And I want to begin with Florence, because that's what's our main topic for today. And what was it about Florence that all these giants of Renaissance history that attracted all these people? And what was it that made it such a great Renaissance city?
Well, in some ways, it was a curious place because, unlike Venice, for example, or even Genoa, it is not a seaport. It wasn't enriched by the Crusades. It wasn't Rome with the international connections of the church. It was inland on the River Arno, which is not really navigable in the summer. And it's in a river valley, unlike most of the cities in Tuscany, because it's not in a Tuscan foundation. But what it did have, it had a tradition of producing extraordinarily high quality woolen cloth. And it had to do not only with the quality of the sheep, but also with the skills of the artisans and the control of the cloth business by international merchants. And the result was the enormous profits that came from clothing the nobility and wealthy merchants, mostly in Northern Europe, but also elsewhere in Italy. And the profits that came from that and the mercantile connections that allowed for Florentines to establish really what amounts to branches of their company in important cities like Bruges or Paris or wherever. And the enormous profits that initially came from the woolen cloth industry was then used to start banking. Because what do you do with surplus capital? And the surplus capital was used to make loans to other merchants, or especially to kings and princes who were busy in the 14th century in particular and building states, dynastic territorial monarchies. And Florentine bankers helped them do that by making funds available. So Florence became enormously wealthy, and also it succeeded in establishing what really is a guild republic. The Ordinances of Justice of 1293 tossed out the old feudal magnates and their urban associates and established in its place a republic that would last from 1293 really until 1530, with little bits and pieces in between in which the republic was compromised, but essentially lasted throughout the entire period of the Renaissance, with a collective executive of nine men and the interests of the dominant mercantile class becoming central. So that's how it got its wealth and how it became interested in new forms of education and new models of culture really fell from that. Because these merchants rejected the traditional feudal rural values of the Middle Ages and then were looking for new elements to validate their position in society, their social mobility, the acquisition of new wealth, the access to political power that wasn't inherited. And they saw a model in the ancient world. When they looked at the ancient world, they saw a statesman like Cicero, someone very much like them, involved in a republic, in fact, gave his life trying to save the republic, a scholar educated at the school that Plato founded in Athens, the Academy, Neoplatonic writer and thinker, but a politician who moved socially from the equestrian to the senatorial class, married, had children, was deeply involved in almost every aspect of civil life. So the ancient world spoke much more effectively to these elite, privileged rulers of the city of Florence. And so they began to adopt as a kind of class ideology these values. And as they began to adopt them, they began to see that there was an opportunity to not only replicate classical models, but to adapt them to suit their own particular needs in the time in which they were alive. So that's the basic general background.
And I want to begin with one of the perhaps most famous Florentines who ever existed, perhaps. And of course, I don't discuss several famous people in our conversation, but one of them, of course, need no introduction. And that is Dante, who, of course, wrote Dante's Inferno Eterno. And he would have a kind of tragic end, I think, with his exile. And because I really loved Florence, and let's talk about how he came and to become the famous writer that he is today.
Well, Dante is a figure that I largely ascribe to the Middle Ages. In fact, the first lecture in my Renaissance culture course, I explain why I don't begin with Dante, but I do begin with Petrarch. Dante was very much part of that mercantile aristocratic elite that took power after 1293. He was a Guelph because the Guelphs had assumed power in the city and had the support of the papacy. But in the power struggles after 1293, he found himself on the losing side of the division within the Guelphs. He was a much more liberal Guelph who didn't want the papacy to essentially control the circumstances of Florence. So when the so-called Black Guelphs took power with the help of a papal army, Dante and Petrarch's father were exiled in 1301. Their property was confiscated, and he spent the rest of his life as a wanderer. He never returned to Florence. He died in 1321 in Ravenna. And it was in this circumstance that he wrote the Commedia. He had already established himself to a degree as a thinker and a poet and a scholar, but it was the experience of seeing Florence from without that allowed him to interpret not only his fellow citizens but also the circumstances of his life and the tragedy of his exile as a kind of metaphor for the human journey through life, and that's why he begins on that Selva Oscura, and because the classical world had already begun to influence men of his class, he chose Virgil as his guide in hell and purgatory. But of course, as even as a justified pagan, Virgil couldn't take him to heaven, so his divine Beatrice, that idealized, almost courtly love figure, does that. But the reason I begin with Petrarch rather than with Dante is that Dante still largely thought like a medieval person. And the Virgil that leads him is not really the Virgil of the Aeneid, it's the Virgil of the Eclogue that seems to foretell the coming of Christ. As like an Old Testament prophet, he becomes a justified pagan, but one who has foreknowledge of the Christian dispensation, but didn't benefit from it. So this really is the Virgil. And similarly, if you go through hell and purgatory, what you see is you see the seven deadly sins in operation. And they're the medieval structures in which Dante's mind still operated, punishment and reward. So Dante really thought like a medieval person. Similarly, there's scholastic method in the way he formulates his poetic journey. And ultimately, in heaven, when he's led by Beatrice towards knowledge of God, it's really through saints like Saint Bernard who take him there. So I think Dante, despite the fact that he was very transitional and he illustrated examples of what would come after, was still mostly a medieval thinker. It was his younger contemporary, Francesco Petrarca, who was born in 1304, that really begins the intellectual and cultural revolution that we associate with the Renaissance.
And you mentioned that Dante was a Guelph, so let's go into what was a Guelph and Ghibelline, because they were kind of important to Florence as well.
Well, yes. I mean, if Gilbert and Sullivan is right, and every child born alive is either a little liberal or a little conservative, well, everyone born in Italy during the Middle Ages was either a Guelph or a Ghibelline. And the struggle is, of course, largely political, and worked out in terms of personalities and the geopolitical circumstances of individual papacies and individual imperial rule. But the problem really comes down to the question of sovereignty. With the collapse of the Roman Empire, who succeeded the empire in terms of the imperial sovereignty that Rome used to exercise? The emperors, especially after Charlemagne was crowned Holy Roman Emperor on Christmas Day of 800 in Rome, the Holy Roman Emperors claimed that they were the successors of Roman rule in the West. However, a very crafty forgery that was believed until Lorenzo Valla proved it to be a forgery in the middle of the 15th century, the so-called Donation of Constantine, which was written in the latter part of the 8th century, stated that Constantine, in recognition of the popes having cured him of leprosy, gave the rule of the West to the Pope, to Pope Sylvester, when Constantine moved house and took the capital to Constantinople. This allowed the papacy then to claim universal sovereignty. And they had a double claim because it was not only through the donation of Constantine, but also through the apostolic succession. St. Peter, according to this belief, charged Peter with caring for his church, and Peter was the successor of was Christ's vicar on earth, and so consequently his successors as Bishop of Rome then wielded that ecclesiastical power. So popes claim to have both jurisdiction in the spiritual as well as in the temporal realm, something that they claimed right up until really the second half of the 19th century. And there's still memories of it today when the Pope wears red shoes, the way Roman emperors used to wear red shoes. And there are these memories that exist. But in terms of how it worked out in Italy, it really depended very much on local circumstances. Because Italy was an unstable place, continually warring. It was a mosaic of states. It was a small jurisdictions because Rome, the Roman unity of the peninsula had completely shattered by the 5th century. And the rulers of these states were looking for justification for their rule. They were seeking sovereignty. And whether they went to the emperor and claimed that they were ruling in the name of the emperor, or whether they went to the pope to claim that they were papal vicars, depended on really local circumstances. So in a Ghibelline city like Milan, the house of Visconti was established because the emperor was able to do it. And the Visconti then claimed that they were ruling in the name of the emperor. But in Guelph cities, because of the power of the bishop, because the Ghibellines were weaker, any number of reasons, the Guelphs claimed that their sovereignty came from the Pope. But it was really an issue that came down to family, local, political concerns, that it came to if your enemy were Ghibelline, like Siena was Ghibelline, you were Guelph, and Florence was Guelph, and vice versa. It provided protection because Ghibelline states could form alliances, Guelph states could form alliances. And in particular in Italy, the Guelph position was strong because of the role of the cadet branch of the House of France, the House of Anjou, invited by the papacy to come into Italy and clean things up. So the Guelphs, in fact, had a kind of standing army through the King of Naples, and the Ghibellines had to rely on either local forces or the occasional incursion of Holy Roman emperors across the Alps. So it was really an issue of sovereignty, and one that wasn't altogether solved until really the middle of the 16th century, when all of these things were vestigial and they were memories more than anything else. Although there were still, as I said, vestigial elements in the period of Italian unification, the Risorgimento, when Pius IX claimed sovereignty as Christ vicar on earth, and consequently the right to rule over the papal states, and refused to compromise with Italian unification. So it's a long and complicated story, but mostly it has to do with why do I have the right to rule?
And of course, another part for Italy we have to talk about is the Popolo Minuto, of course, which was the lower merchant class. What was their role in Florence, and how did they become known as the Popolo Minuto?
Well, Florence was again unusual because it had a very large, what we would now call industrial working class. The production of cloth is labor intensive as well as capital intensive. And one of the things that the mercantile elite did in order to ensure that they would control the city is in 12, I think it was 1289, they liberated all the serfs in the Florentine Contado, the territory dependent on Florence. And that meant that there would be a constant supply of cheap labor. So these peasants from the countryside would continue to come into the city, and they would work in the cloth industry. They were paid a living wage when the industry was booming or when there was a shortage of labor. They were terribly oppressed and unemployed and often driven from the city when the cloth industry was languishing and there wasn't much of a market for Florentine cloth. They were oppressed in every way. Their salaries were mostly sufficient to maintain basic level of life when things were going well, but there was constant period there were constant periods of unemployment, and there were moments when their oppression reached the stage where it was necessary to act. And the most dramatic of those was the Ciompi Revolt of 1378, when, because of a war against the papacy, the War of the Eight Saints, beginning in 1375, because of the decline in the Florentine cloth industry as a consequence, because of some local issues, the Ciompi revolted and they claimed power. It wasn't, as Marxist historians often write, an early Marxist a class revolution. It wasn't that at all, because what the Ciompi wanted is that they wanted in. They wanted to form a guild. They wanted part of the guild government of the city. So they got one, the Guild of the People of God, the Arte del Popolo di Dio, and a guild that was so large it was three times the total political population of the city. And they consequently held office. They held office as priors. One of them, their leader, Michele di Lando, ended up as Gonfaloniere di Giustizia, the kind of chair of the collective executive. And they began to agitate for better working conditions, higher salaries, and so on. This was something that couldn't be tolerated. So by 1381, the Ciompi guilds were suppressed, and they were oppressed even more. Many of them were executed. Their overseers were no longer Italians. They were often Flemings because they didn't speak Italian, and there was no way that there could be any kind of organization. The role of Michele di Lando terrified the political classes. So the popolo minuto, the poor, were like almost everybody in pre-modern times, living a life that was nasty, brutish, and short. So the situation of the poor in Florence was not particularly good. They relied on charity when necessary, but they could reproduce their numbers and even expand when their fertility rates rose. There was more immigration into the city, and they had better salaries and some measure of security. But these periods were always interspersed with terror, with terrible periods of great suffering.
And of course, the next person I want to talk about, I don't have too much time, so I have to move on as on that. But it's a rather peculiar artist, I find, because Giotto, of course, is mostly known for his famous perfect circle. And I want to, and his background as well is rather fascinating to me, because that as well, it's kind of sounds like a bit of probably useless strike of good luck, if you ask me.
So much of what we know, of course, comes from Vasari's Lives of the Artist, first edition of which was 1550, so 200 years after Giotto. And what Vasari was doing is creating almost a hagiography, because the model for the Lives of the Artist are actually collections of saints' lives. So you had to find what Vasari called i primi lumi, the first lights of this new style. And Vasari identifies Cimabue and identifies Giotto as these remarkable people who came out of the magical world of Florence. And Vasari suggests there must be something in the water of the Arno, something of the quality of light that produces generation after generation. The reality is what we talked about before, that those merchants, having seized power in 1293, needed new models of self-knowledge and self-awareness and a vocabulary of communication. They needed to live in a real world, that is, reproducing what the eye sees. They lived in a secular world where secular education was extremely important and where these things continued. And the themes of a painter like Giotto are, of course, largely religious, but at the same time, there's a secular element in as much as the characters have individual personalities. They have that tactile quality, is what Bernard Berenson described it. You could walk around them, you can hug them, and there's also an emotional relationship amongst the characters. So these were divine figures that had been beamed down from heaven in order to illuminate God's plan for man. These were human beings, and they were ambitious. They functioned as human beings. So it's not an accident that, among Giotto's great works are the works that are patronized by merchants. So the the Arena Chapel, for example, in Padova by the merchant Scrovegni, and in Florence, the two great chapels of the 1320s in Santa Croce, the Bardi and Peruzzi Chapel, were the chapels of great bankers. So there was a sense then of celebrating life on earth and life as it was. And Giotto fulfilled this perfectly, and his new style was revolutionary, but it provided a vocabulary for these new groups in society to exercise their self-image and to communicate themselves and others visually as well as in writing.
I want to talk about this perfect circle, and I want to bring up the story with the Pope as well, as mentioned in the beginning of our conversation about Giotto, because the story has it that the Pope sent an envoy because he heard of the Giotto's impressive paintings, and an envoy didn't. Oh, it's just a circle. It's nothing. Even I can do that, but he takes it back to the Pope anyway. But the Pope says, and the Pope is impressed, and he says that you don't seem to understand art much at all, to the guy envoy he sent, and he was. So, I was really impressed by Giotto's perfect circle.
And Giotto was invited to Rome. He painted the cathedral of parts of the Cathedral of Rome, St. John Lateran, under Boniface VIII. He traveled all through the peninsula. These stories, of course, are like saints' legends. They justify genius. They are an opportunity to connect powerful people like popes or rich merchants or the Franciscan order at Assisi with painting. So I always tell my students to look at these stories the same way you look at saints' legends. St. Augustine was right. If these things build faith, they become true. And if you understand Giotto's message from the perspective of a pope or a merchant, then these legends have some measure of truth or validity. But the reality is that Giotto was a painter like almost all others, but one with perhaps greater talent and a desire to reinterpret how the visual world operated. So the saints' legends are wonderful, but are they true? There's an Italian saying, "Se non è vero, è ben trovato." Doesn't matter if it's true. If it makes a good story, it, like a religious belief, provides truth.
But I want to know how, do we know how it managed to do the perfect circle? That how the technology, I think, or maybe not technology is the right word, but how he used, how he managed to create this perfect circle is, yeah, you can look it up on Google. It really is a piece of brilliant work, and it's simple, but still it's so hard to do. You can try to draw a perfect circle yourself, see how easy it is. But let's start, do we know how he managed to do this?
Well, are you talking about Leonardo now?
Giotto and his perfect
Giotto.
circle.
Oh, well, yeah, the story is that he was able to draw it, and well, he perhaps could. But they were all kinds of instruments for creating perfect circles, and there's a huge backstory here. It goes back to antiquity. What did Plato have above the gates of the academy? "Let none ignorant of geometry enter here." The belief that the not only the five Platonic solids, but geometry in general, constituted the vocabulary in the language of God. And the reason for that is that the square and the hypotenuse is always equal to the square and the other two sides, regardless who you are, where you are, your condition, because it's an absolute truth. And the parallel is, of course, with the absolute truth of divine revelation. So God becomes the great geometer, and that is something that was portrayed right up to right up until the 19th century. William Blake produces God as a great geometer, and it was a medieval trope as well. What we're seeing is the mixture of a whole bunch of intellectual and cultural elements, of baggage of Western civilization. That's mixed around. The baggage is there, but you mix the stuff in your cases from one place to another, and you use what is necessary under the circumstances in order to make your point. So the use of geometry, and again, we could go into this. We could talk about Brunelleschi's use of geometry in the Pasi Chapel or in the old sacristy of San Lorenzo, doing exactly the same thing. Creating an element of perfection that allows man not to become God, but to exercise the power that God has given man through his reason, through his ability to speak, and also through his understanding and his soul. So that's really where it comes from. It's not just somebody being able to draw a circle, it's somebody who reinterprets an old idea that predates Christianity and applies it to another kind of saint's life. So Vasari is creating a saint's life, and the ability to mediate between God and man is one of the things that saints do. So Giotto becomes a kind of saint.
So, of course, the next thing I want to talk about is, of course, the famous Medicis. And I want to, I'm brief in the background because we're going to focus on two Medicis here. They had several Medicis produced, and they were the famous bankers of the Renaissance. But I want to, before, after we give it in the background on them, I want to focus on Cosimo Medici and Lorenzo the Magnificent. But, and like I said, first, let's give a brief in the background on how the Medici came to power.
The thing about the Republic that was created in 1293 is it was inherently unstable because it had a collective executive. You held office for only 2 months as a prior, and then you couldn't hold office for the next 3 years. There was a complex system of election of lots and votes and all sorts of things, and there were then the conflicts within the city, conflicts over business, family feuds, all kinds of things. The Republic then wasn't a stable structure, and this worked itself out in a number of crises. The collapse of the economy in the 1340s, the Black Death, the Ciampi Revolt, all of these things really reflect how the instability of the Republic was manifested. So by the time we get to the beginning of the 14th century, we see that the world that it was that came about after the Chanty Revolt was one of aristocratic privilege and the manipulation of the Republic for the benefit of those wealthiest merchants who formed an oligarchy, which got ever smaller. The problem with that is that it not disenfranchised, but it marginalized large numbers of people who did have political access, who were eligible for office, but who were really kept out because of the manipulation of the system. And the oligarchs realized that they had a problem in their hands, and they realized that the leader of the opposition was the wealthiest man in Europe, the head of the Medici Bank, who was very sophisticated, very knowledgeable, very cultivated, but he had no interest in being part of the oligarchy. He actually saw himself as the leader of the Popolani, the popular party against the oligarchs. The oligarchs tried in 1433 to neutralize him by trumping up charges of treason. They arrested him. They were going to execute him, but the Pope and the Duke of Ferrara and all kinds of other people said, if you do that, you're going to be our enemies. So they exiled him in perpetuity and confiscated some of his property. But doing that precipitated the very revolt the oligarchs feared the most. So in 1434, Cosimo de' Medici was invited back to the city, and he came back to Florence, in which the oligarchs had been expelled, their palaces were burned, and there was a power vacuum. Cosimo could have done anything at that point. He could have declared himself the ruler of Florence, but he was an ideological Republican, and he truly believed in the distribution of power broadly over people who own property, paid taxes, and employed others. So instead of changing the Republic, he in fact allowed it to operate from everybody's perspective without any change. He made one tiny constitutional alteration. He ensured that his supporters would be a majority in the Accoppiatori. That is, that's the committee who determined who was going to be eligible for political office and how they were chosen. And by doing that, he could decide how much opposition he wanted, how many members of the opposition he would accept, or the degree to which he was going to impose his own will on the city. And this is the way he ruled from 1434 until his death in 1464. He manipulated things from behind the scenes. He used his own wealth to support the Republic in really dramatic ways. He not only patronized art, he helped out the state treasury when necessary. He provided an example. He did all sorts of things that made him not only a superb ruler, but also highly respected. So when he died in 1464, he was given the same title that Cicero had been given of Pater Patriae, the father of his people. And buried in Santa Croce underneath Verrocchio's tomb cover. And he was almost a place of pilgrimage. So the thing about the Medici is that they began by being a political machine, manipulating a republic that still operated in ways that to most citizens hadn't changed. His son, Piero, who ruled from 1464 to 1469, was not as successful. Partly he was ill. He had the family disease of gout. He was always in pain. He was short-tempered. And he had been raised as a prince. There were many conspiracies against him as a consequence. And had he lived much longer, my thought would be that the Medici would have been thrown out. But he had the good sense to die young. He died in 1469. And he was succeeded by his 20-year-old son, Lorenzo the Magnificent, a truly remarkable human being. An excellent poet, someone with a common touch, as well as being fantastically elegant, extremely intelligent, and he followed his father's model of manipulating the Republic and bringing in members of the proud patrician families so that they didn't feel isolated. He ruled in many ways brilliantly. It was a great moment for Florence. Florence was wealthy. It had significant diplomatic interest because His grandfather had arranged with the new Duke of Milan, Francesco Sforza, a division of power in the Italian peninsula and the Peace of Lodi. After 1454, there were five major states. They had spheres of influence, and those were recognized. After 1455, the Italian League put them all together to protect Italy from foreign invasions. So it was a time of incredible peace in Italy. It was a time of security and stability. And that allowed money to be spent on things like culture, art, patronage, and some social experiments as well, which are quite remarkable. But in 1478, Lorenzo crossed Pope Sixtus IV and his totally obnoxious family. And the result was a conspiracy within the city led by the Pazzi family, an extremely old, very rich family that had feudal origins, but had been rehabilitated into the city as bankers, the Pope and the Pope's nephew. There was an attempt to murder Lorenzo and his younger brother Giuliano in the cathedral at Easter in 1478. Unfortunately, Giuliano was murdered. Lorenzo escaped, only wounded. And there was then the War of the Pazzi conspiracy against the Pope, and between 1478 and 1480, and only Lorenzo's personal intervention of going to Naples and dealing with Ferrante of Naples, a king who was the papal leader of the papal army, that brought an end to it, together with some other events like the Turks taking Otranto and stuff that we haven't got time to talk about. But Lorenzo was different after 1480. And Florence became a different place. He became much more distant, a bit paranoid. He traveled with armed guards. He established a new council, a council of 70, that gave Medici supporters an automatic control over the deliberations of the Republic. And he himself became more, I think, inward. Not only his art patronage became small personal private objects that he would keep now in the Gabinetto degli Argenti in the Pitti, but also his growing interest that had begun actually under his grandfather of Neoplatonic ideas, ideas that had to do with the search for perfection and the ideal, the reading of very difficult texts, conversations and difficult poetry and difficult art. The world of Poliziano, the world of Botticelli, the world of early Michelangelo, these, and of course the philosophical works of Marsilio Ficino and Pico della Mirandola. This was a world that separated the Medici culturally from the vast majority of the Florentine population, not just the poor, but even the mercantile elite. They wanted to make profits. They were hard-headed. The Italians say Fiorentini sono sempre in bottega, and indeed they are. They're always thinking of profit. They're not thinking about absolute perfection. So the Medici began in some ways a decline as a consequence of the Pazzi conspiracy and being separated from the major cultural movements of the vast majority of the population. This was capitalized by Girolamo Savonarola, who was a Dominican monk from Ferrara, who had been appointed the abbot of the monastery of San Marco. And he played upon the deep religious traditions and the mystical traditions of Florence, the Fraticelli, the spiritual Franciscans, the prophecies of Joachim of Fiore, the love of Saint Antonino, the Archbishop of Florence, and his support for the poor. And as a result, the Medici became more isolated, and Savonarola got more and more popular influence. And when Lorenzo died very young, in his early 40s, in 1492, the Medici largely collapsed, in part because his son, Piero, was every father's nightmare. He was a braggart, he was a brawler, he was stupid, he was paranoid, he was everything his father was not. And he lasted barely 2 years before the French invasions and Savonarola's influence ensured the Medici were going to be expelled and a new form of government created. won until 1498 under Savonarola's influence, but still a republic and a very broadly based republic. And then after Savonarola's fall, a broadly based republic that produced Niccolo Machiavelli, who was its second chancellor. So that's the Medici.
And of course, the Medici has a whole lot bigger story than it's just covered here, and I do plan to cover them eventually in the future. So hopefully one day I will cover them as well. But you mentioned nicely in there, so let's talk about Machiavelli, because he's probably one of the most famous Florentines to ever exist, I think. If you, of course, you don't know Leonardo da Vinci as well, but Machiavelli perhaps equally so. So let's talk a little bit about Machiavelli, because Machiavelli is become, of course, a famous term as well.
Yes, Machiavelli is not only fantastically interesting, but he's actually an incredibly attractive character. Most people think of Machiavelli only as the author of The Prince, but The Prince is a small work that was occasioned for at a particular moment in 1513. Machiavelli, who had been second chancellor of the Republic, responsible for a lot of diplomatic work, was a genius in almost every way. He wrote brilliant diplomatic responses. He was a great diplomat himself. He wrote plays, and Andragola is still performed, still funny. His letters are wonderful reading. He wrote very thoughtful books like the Discourses on Livy, which is really Discourses on Florence, using Livy as a kind of excuse. But The Prince is remembered because it seemed to talk about a new kind of statecraft in which amorality and whatever worked would be acceptable. And we have to put it in context. Machiavelli was a republican in every way. He was high-minded. He was a republican in office and in theory, and the discourses make this absolutely clear. He was a Florentine patriot, as the first and second decades indicate real so clearly. But he also was a patriot who realized that Florence was endangered, an existential danger, and he needed consequently to provide an alternative. He provided a solution, and the solution was harsh. The coming of a man on horseback who would then solve all the problems of Florence and then go away. This is a Florentine tradition. They had done it in 1313. They had done it in 1327. They had done it in so many instances. But what he was suggesting is that for Italy to be free, because he talks about Italy. In fact, he uses Petrarch's Italia Mia as chapter 26 of The Prince. He says that we have to be more barbarous than the barbarians. We've got to forget our principles and our values in order to save ourselves, and then we can go back. He thinks of Cincinnatus, the Roman dictator who saved the Republic, but then gave up power willingly and went back to his plow and started right back in the same furrow that he had started before being called. So The Prince is an occasion piece. It's to save Italy from the barbarians in 1513. It was dedicated to the Medici governors of the city, ruling in the name of a pope. So you can't think of Machiavelli as the author of The Prince only. You have to, as I tell my students, if you read The Prince, you've got to read it in the context of the Discourses on Livy. He was writing the two simultaneously. And it really explains so much of what The Prince is all about. But Machiavelli is an extremely attractive character. He never got his jog back. He was given the charge to write a history of Florence by the future Pope Clement VII, and the history of Florence is one of the great works of historiography. He was a remarkable human being, and one that you would really like to have dinner with, one that you'd like to spend time with.
So, unfortunately, we don't have time to do for Jimmy, we don't have time to go into Leonardo da Vinci as much as we would love to. But I want to end the last person, of course, is one. And there's just a few famous people, and I think most people will be familiar with our last person on the list, which is Galileo Galilei.
Okay, let me just say a few words about Leonardo because there's actually a
Yeah.
kind of connection. Leonardo wasn't born in Florence, he was born in Vinci, and he was trained in Florence in the workshop of Verrocchio. But he didn't really get on very well in Florence. He didn't like the continual need to compete with other workshops. He worked too slowly. He didn't like changing, and the Medici hated him because he was charged twice with sodomy, never convicted. But the reason, one of the reasons he wasn't convicted, is that he was indicted with a member of the Tornabuoni family, and that was Lorenzo's mother's family. Lucrezia Tornabuoni was Lorenzo's mother, and so Leonardo was associated with, and he was very openly living as a gay man in Florence, and was an extremely attractive figure in many ways, always dressing in pink, superb dancer, great swordsman, brilliant musician who could do almost anything. So he wasn't really a success in Florence. Galileo is a different situation. First of all, the world had changed. He grew up in the period of the Medici monarchy. The Medici monarchy was Medici monarchy was established after 1530 and became a hereditary monarchy after 1537 under Cosimo I. And the intellectual world became smaller. And the role of the church, especially at the end of the 16th century, after the Council of Trent, after the need to control ideas, operated in Florence the way it operated almost everywhere else. Galileo, remember, was taught not in Florence, but he taught in Pisa, where he was a professor of mathematics and other things, dropping lead balls from the Torre Pendente. Then he went to Padova. He taught in Padova for a number of years. He actually didn't spend that much time in Florence. He came from a patrician family. His father was a member of a camerata, the musical group that actually gave Leonardo one of his experiments about how to measure time by the vibration on strings. But he spent most of his time away. And when he did return to Florence, he was attacked by the conservative clergy, especially the Dominicans of Santa Croce, because what he said was contrary to, in some ways, 17th century common sense after 1616. And that is, the world isn't the way it appears to be. It's actually far more complex. And it agreed with Copernicus's 1543 De Revolutionibus, which said that the sun was the center of the universe and not the earth. Galileo proved that this indeed was the case. He went further. He used his telescope, something he largely invented, they perfected, to show that the moon
Or
wasn't
was
a
it the
perfect.
telescope really a German invention, as far as I
Well, yeah, it
heard?
was invented in a Dutch invention. Yeah, it was invented. Well, the ancients had telescopes. The ancients had used the ground lens, and Robert Grosseteste, the Bishop of Lincoln in the 13th century, had a telescope. But it's one thing to have one that's used as a toy or used to set the sails of ships on fire, like the Greeks of Syracuse did. It's something else to change the way we see ourselves in the universe, which is what Galileo did. He looked through his telescope, and what he saw was that the moon wasn't perfect. The moon was cratered and ugly. This was a challenge as well, because the book of Genesis said only the earth fell because of the sin of Adam and Eve. The rest of the universe should have been perfect because God creates only perfect things. And he said, no, that's not the case at all. He was hauled up before the Inquisition for teaching Copernicanism, for arguing all sorts of things the church did not accept, and for writing a very famous letter to the wife of the Grand Duke of Tuscany, the Medici Grand Duke, Grand Duchess Christina. And in that letter, he said, if you want to know about science and about the rational world and the universe, don't go to scripture. Go to experimentation. Go to what you can see. Go to what you can prove. That there's no point in arguing that the earth must be the center of the universe because God allowed Joshua to make the sun stand still. So that's not an argument. So Galileo said we must first trust our own senses, our experiments, and mathematical proof. And that got him into a great deal of trouble. He was charged by the Inquisition to stop teaching Copernicanism. He did for a while, but then he wrote his great book, Dialogue on the
I
Two
bet he
Great
did not
Works.
expect the Inquisition, did he?
No, he didn't know the Spanish. You never expect the Spanish Inquisition, as we know from Monty Python. But he, the thing about it is that again, it's very complicated, and you have to know how the Inquisition worked in order to understand this.
And
Galileo's trial.
if I may add to this, we did actually make an episode early on in the podcast about the Spanish Inquisition, and where we discussed how the Spanish Inquisition works. So if you want to take a look at closer, I highly recommend checking out our episode about should you expect the Spanish Inquisition.
And the Spanish Inquisition was different from the Roman Inquisition, which was established by Paul III in 1543, together with the Index of Prohibited Books at around the same time, and all of those other things. But what the Inquisition simply adjourned Galileo's trial. He still was under orders not to teach Copernicanism. But he wrote his great book, The Dialogue of the Two Great World Systems, that is Copernicanism, that is the geocentric and heliocentric universe. And it got an accidental imprimatur from the Inquisition. Galileo was a friend of the Pope, and Galileo thought he was safe because he didn't come down on one side or the other. He simply put the argument out there in an open dialogue. But the Inquisition, led by Roberto Bellarmine and others, said, nope, he's still a heretic. He's still practicing heresy. He was brought before the Inquisition and given a choice. He could either be executed and burned as a consummation heretic, or he could abjure. He was old, he was almost blind, and he chose the latter with those famous words, Eppure si muove, and yet it, the earth, moves. He was sentenced to house arrest for the rest of his life in his Villa d'Arcetri, a villa that you walk by today, walking up to the top of the hill. So Galileo was an unusual case. He came from Florentine rationalism, but he spent not very much time in Florence, except at the end of his life when he was imprisoned there. So we really must see him as an Italian and suffering from the Italian Roman Inquisition, as opposed to anything that was particularly Florentine.
I want to end there with what would you say is the legacy of all these people and the Renaissance Florence that we still is with us today? What would you say the legacy of Renaissance Florence is?
What did it, sorry?
The legacy of the Renaissance
Well,
Florence.
the legacy of the Renaissance is to create a world that's based on human values, to accept the concepts of human agency, human autonomy, that we make ourselves the invention of the autonomous individual, which was really beginning with Petrarch, that we make ourselves the people that we are. We're not actors in a play written by God. We are not simply here to illustrate the divine plan for man. We can make the world better, make ourselves better, make the community better through the application of our reason and our words, in particular our speech. We can externalize our experience by inventing linear perspectives and correct anatomy so that we can reproduce what the eye sees. We can, in other words, create an imaginary world to function as a metaphor for the real world, but it's up to every individual to interpret that according to his or her own experience and his or her own needs. And that, I think, is the great contribution of the Renaissance.
And I think that's a wonderful message, and we're going to end it there. Thank you so much for coming on. Before you go, do you have any social media or anything, any place where people can buy your books, which I would highly recommend to do? And I will do this myself. So,
The books are all available on Amazon and either the Renaissance in Italy, a history is a good place to start. A short history of the Italian Renaissance, which I wrote in the University of Toronto Press. The Age of the Medici and Savonarola by Hackett. These are all available, and you could follow up what I've been saying and in much more detail by reading the books.
thank you so much for coming on. We even had a little minor musical number today, which is a first for the podcast. This has been Without Aged Well. You can find us on Twitter or X, whatever it is called these days, under Without Aged Well. We are available on Instagram under Without Aged Well. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. If you are on Apple iTunes or iTunes, please consider writing a review, and I would try to read it out on the podcast. That would certainly help us out a lot if you're on Spotify. give us 5 stars. That would be nice. And on YouTube, please like, share, and subscribe. My name is Alan, and I will see you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.